Let me freeze time before it turns cold. Moments go by and life goes on. The torturous stars are taking every breath. I wish I'd held the love in my heart. It's never ending.
Chapter 34. Epilogue. Après moi, le déluge.
All I can give you is memories. Carry them with you and I'll never leave. I'll lay my head down, but when I lay my head down, don't let me go. Hold me in your beating heart. I won't let go.
Naboo, 13 years ago, 1 year before the liberation of Naboo. Padme found Obi-Wan sitting on one of the palace balconies, staring distractedly at the sunset over the plains on the waterfall side of the city. He had Master Jin's lightsaber in his lap, but he wasn't looking at it. In the distance, the impact of the Trade Federation bombardment against the city's shields was clearly visible, like fireworks at the Festival of Light. "Have we been able to get through to Coruscant yet?" Obi-Wan asked, without looking at her. Padme settled down beside him, folding her bare feet beneath her skirts. The stone was still warm from the sun, though the heat was fading fast. "No, comms are still jammed." He nodded, apparently unsurprised. "Are the shields still holding?" "For now. A group of Gungan refugees came in through the East Gate a few hours ago. We've put them with the others." She paused, wondering how much he already knew, and added, "The Trade Federation hasn't tried to make contact again. Cads and Panaka thinks that they won't make another attempt until morning."
"That would fit the pattern."
After a moment, he turned towards her.
"I've been trying to reach Master Yoda at the Jedi Temple through the Force, but I'm not strong enough. By now they must have realized that something went wrong."
Padme looked at him, at the tight, worried expression on his face, and realized for the first time how very scared he was. "Will the Jedi come, even if Senator Palpatine can't convince the Senate to intervene?" He thought about it for a few moments, and finally said,
"I don't know. Qui-Gon and I were already assigned to mediate, so it was all right for us to come. But technically, we're not supposed to interfere in disputes between two sovereign states without Senate permission. Even military disputes, especially military disputes. The Trade Federation is powerful enough that the Senate could even forbid the Jedi to interfere. It wouldn't be the first time."
It should have been a blow, but somehow Padme had already known what he was going to say. If the Jedi were going to come, then they would have done so by now. Obi-Wan picked at the fabric of his trousers and said,
"If I could contact the temple and let them know about the creature that killed Qui-Gon, then they would have to come. He killed a Jedi, which means he comes under our jurisdiction."
"The Trade Federation will say you're lying."
"Probably."
He rested his hands loosely in his lap and looked off into the distance, at the shields on the other side of the valley and the blast spattering harmlessly against them.
"On impulse," Padme said, "you could get out. There are still some fighters left. Once you got past the shields, you could claim diplomatic immunity and go back to Coruscant to bring the rest of the Jedi." He shook his head.
"I can't do that."
"Don't you know how to fly?"
Obi-Wan turned on her indignantly.
"Of course I know how to fly. I'm probably the best pilot here."
"Oh, you're joking." Padme smiled. It felt strange on her face, as though she hadn't done so for a long time. After a moment, she realized that she couldn't remember the last time she had.
Before the invasion, probably.
Is there anything you can't do? He was silent for a worryingly long period of time. Just as Pepno was starting to wonder if the answer to that question actually was no, he said, "This, what you do." "What's that?" "Rule," Obi-Wan said. Padme pulled her knees up to her chest. "I'm not exactly queen over much right now. Just Theed, and that could easily change tomorrow if the shields failed." Obi-Wan smiled at her, his expression tired. "That's not what I meant. Most people would have given up a long time ago. You haven't." "Would you have?" He seemed surprised by the question. "That's not the kind of question Jedi ever really have to consider. We never have to make that call." He paused. "But that's not what I meant either. You believe so strongly. I've never seen that in someone who wasn't a Jedi before." "Don't worry," Padme said dryly, but she was oddly flattered by his sincere tone. "There's still enough time for all of us to be killed because of what I believe."
"I don't think that's going to happen," Obi-Wan said.
"That would be too easy." Coruscant, Galactic Republic, present day. The Senate building was quieter than Mace had ever seen it before. In the wake of the attack on the Chancellor, many senators had opted to return to their homeworlds rather than remain on Coruscant, while others had chosen to conduct their affairs either in their apartments or in the Senate Annex, the dome-shaped building near the Senate building where many senators had their offices. Others had merely gone. Mace found the near-empty corridors of the massive building eerie. He was distantly aware of a rumble that might have been the construction droids who were attempting to renovate the damaged convocation chamber, but it could as easily have been the ceaseless traffic outside, or even his own imagination. While normally he would have expected to see dozens of senators, representatives, and their retinues and bodyguards, not to mention lobbyists, journalists, and the other sentient detritus politics seemed to attract, this time he only passed a few droids, and more Senate guards than he had ever seen in the building before. They watched Mace pass with narrowed eyes behind their helmets. He knew that the Blues had taken heavy losses during the attack on Dooku. That it had occurred at all, they considered a personal insult. The current captain of the guard had been hastily promoted following her predecessor's death in the battle. Of course, with so many senators having left the Republic in the past week, many of the Blues must have abruptly found themselves out of an assignment and been retasked to the Senate building. Mace hadn't heard of any guards who had chosen to betray their oaths to the Republic and accompany their charges off-world. The doors to the executive office slid open as he approached, emitting Senator Tykes of Dak. The Quarren came charging out, his tentacles waving slightly in dismay. He almost barged straight past Mace before recognizing and coming to a halt, forcing Mace to stop before he ran into the other being. "You!" he said in his watery voice, jabbing a finger in the direction of Mace's sternum. Mace fixed him with a glare, and Tykes stopped just short of actually touching him.
"Senator,
I demand that the Jedi remove that infestation from Dak," Tykes sputtered. "That boy King has gone too far this time, and now the entire Confederate fleet is roosting at our doorstep. The Char did not have the authority to remove the system from the Republic. The Jedi must act. This is an insult to our planetary sovereignty."
"The matter will be taken under consideration," Mace said, since it seemed the only way to keep Tykes from ranting for the next half hour. "I'll bring it up to the Chancellor myself."
"What do you think I've just been doing?" the Quarren spat. "All he says is that the matter is out of his hands, but if you remove Lee Char—" Mace took a step forward, and Tykes flinched back,
his tentacles waving frantically.
"The Jedi are not assassins," he said. "I will discuss the matter with Chancellor Dooku. Good day, Senator."
Tyke stared at him for a moment, wide-eyed, then shoved past Mace without saying another word, and stomped off down the hall. The two Senate guards standing outside the doors watched him leave without speaking. Mace rubbed at his forehead and sighed as he stepped past the blues into the executive suite antechamber.
This was all he needed.
The antechamber, normally full of petitioners, was empty. Mace walked through it quickly, aware of the wary gazes of two more Senate guards stationed outside the entrance to the executive office itself.
"You're expected, Master Windu," said one of them, touching the control for the doors. They slid open silently.
There were more blues within the executive office itself, along with a pair of Jedi standing quietly along one side of the room. The Jedi Mace had insisted on. He wasn't sure if the blues were there because of the new captain's decision, or whether Dooku had asked for the extra protection.
Knowing Dooku, it was probably the former.
The Supreme Chancellor was sitting at his desk, looking at a hologram in front of him. He glanced up as Mace entered and said,
"Master Windu, how good of you to come."
"Your Excellency."
Mace caught Deepa Balaba's eye and jerked his chin toward the door. She put her hand on her Padawan's shoulder and steered him towards it, though Caleb kept looking back, visibly biting his tongue against asking why they weren't being allowed to stay. Circumspection was not one of his more prominent characteristics, though Deepa was doing her best to instill it in him. At Dooku's gesture, the two Senate guards stepped out too, radiating displeasure that Mace could feel even after the doors had slid shut behind them.
"Certainly we can speak privately, old friend," Dooku said dryly. "Have a seat."
Mace took one of the chairs in front of the desk as Dooku shut off the hologram and leaned forward.
"I didn't expect to see you back in the office so soon," he said.
"I lost a hand, not a head," Dooku pointed out, gesturing at the place where his empty sleeve had been folded and pinned over the stump of his right arm, as though Mace could have missed it. "Every day that I am not in this office is another day that my opponents in the Senate have to use to their advantage. I will not allow this republic to fall because a few idiots seek to turn my injury to their profit." The holonet had been buzzing ever since the attack, which had coincided with the final relays going live again. The techies back at the temple were tracking the news, which was multiplying furiously over various social media sites as best they could, but in the past week it had grown to such epic proportions that it was virtually impossible for a few dozen Jedi who did little but stare at computer screens all day. It wasn't Mace's idea of a good time, but he had always lacked the disposition to be anything other than a knight-errant before he'd become master.
"Have any other systems seceded since the last time I checked the holonet?"
"Only the 107 that the news hasn't gotten hold of yet," Dooku said, sounding disgusted. "Another little slice of the galaxy carved away. These fools aren't even going to the Confederacy or to Palpatine's so-called empire. They have apparently decided to call themselves the Rendili Cluster. Idiots." He curled his left hand into a fist and stared at the space where the hologram had been, his face contorted into a snarl. Mace hadn't been able to keep up with the numbers of systems leaving the Republic, spooked by the attack on the Chancellor. But he knew that there were hundreds, some of them very prominent worlds, that took with them neighboring systems or other systems within their spheres of influence. The Republic looked weak, and its constituent worlds were abandoning it like Minox off a dying starship.
"That's, what, 10 now?"
11. Dooku worked the fingers of his remaining hand. "A week ago, all I had to worry about were the Republic and the Confederacy. And now I have the Republic, the Confederacy, this new empire of Palpatine's, and nearly a dozen other small federations and alliances who have all decided to make a break for, what, freedom?
The Confederacy could eat them alive if Amidala had any interest in conquest. The Empire may well do so, and the Republic doesn't have the forces to spare to bring them back into the fold, or to defend them. Mace took a deep breath. They've made their beds, he said, letting it out in a rush. They'll have to lie in them for now. Their graves, you mean? Dooku leaned back in his chair and turned a little away from Mace to stare out at the floor-to-ceiling window behind him, where the ceaseless air traffic above Coruscant's surface moved by as if the galaxy wasn't falling apart around their ears. From the little that's come out of the former alliance, the new Emperor, his voice dripped sarcasm, is consolidating power. The Force alone knows where he got the troops or the warships, but he's moving to bring the Alliance worlds that refuse to fall in line back into the fold. How is it that none of us had any hints of this? Mace had been ripping apart the Jedi Temple, trying to find out just that. We were focused on the Confederacy, he said. No one thought to look at the Alliance. Damn them. Dooku's mouth twisted. And damn Palpatine, too. Even I underestimated the man. I thought he was nothing more than a lucky fool. I should have known that no fool, no matter how lucky, could maneuver themselves into this seat. He rubbed at his forehead and turned back to Mace. Did you come here just to talk about the Republic? Have you found out anything about the assassin? The Jedi had jurisdiction over any and all Force users, though the Blues were being kept in the loop since the attack had been aimed at Dooku. Mace shook his head. Of something Obi-Wan said when he was in custody, we think she attacked Queen Amidala on several occasions while pretending to be a Jedi. But we don't know anything else. Unfortunately, asking them for information right now isn't likely to go over well. I wouldn't think so, Dooku agreed, his voice dry. The timing could have been better, Mace admitted, grimacing. I'm going to Dathomir myself to speak with the Night Sisters, though I don't expect to get any answers from their leader. Mother Talzin, if she still lives, and all our intelligence suggests that she does, has never been any friend to the Jedi. He paused, considering. Would she be more of a friend to the Sith? Mace had been digging through the temple records in his spare time, trying to work out just that. I don't know, he said. Perhaps more to the Sith than the Jedi, but the Night Sisters... They're very strange. They don't use the Force in anything like the same way we do. Dooku nodded. You're going yourself. I thought the general policy was to send female knights. The Night Sisters don't take well to strange men. Mace scowled at nothing in particular. Relations with other Force traditions in the galaxy had always been drawn. The increasing isolationism of the Jedi over the past decade hadn't helped, and even the Force traditions that tended to be friendly to the Order, which the Night Sisters weren't, were less so at the moment than they had been in decades. It can't be helped. The situation in the temple is tense right now. Dooku raised an eyebrow. I understand that between the return of the Sith and the defections in the Order, Mace sighed. The situation is more complex than that. You believe that Kenobi has other agents within the Order? Agents? No. They would have acted already. Sympathizers? Mace trailed off. Sometimes I understand why you left the Order when you did. Sometimes I envy you. He felt Dooku's start of surprise in the Force, though the other man didn't react physically. Words I never expected to hear from you of all people, my old friend. Is it that bad? Worse. Mace hesitated for a moment, wondering how much to tell him. But of all the Jedi in the Republic, Dooku was the one least likely to be emotionally involved. And they had already kept too many secrets from the executive office.
The only thing keeping the Order from schism right now is the threat of the Sith.
Schism?
Schism, Mace repeated, feeling his mouth twist around the word. The last time the Order had schismed, the resultant war had ripped the galaxy apart. Even now, a millennium later, the Republic was still feeling the repercussions. Dooku leaned forward, his remaining hand clenching into a fist on top of his desk.
Revan's cure, even though it wasn't used?
Mace glanced aside.
It should never have been suggested. Master Voss, Master Unduli,
it was too much for some members of the Order to contemplate, especially for a Jedi fresh from the chamber of the ordeal. He paused, thinking, then shook his head.
No, that doesn't matter. The Order... Well, you know what happened after the occupation of Naboo ended 12 years ago. We made some decisions that perhaps we should not have.
That is certainly one way to describe it, Dooku said, his voice carefully neutral. Mace gave him a sharp look, then shook his head, resting his elbows on his knees and his chin on his fisted hands.
Will the Order schism? Dooku asked after a moment.
I don't know.
Every instinct Mace had said yes, but he was damned if he was going to say it out loud.
Will the Jedi continue to respect orders given by this office?
For now.
Yes. The points of dissent are largely internal.
But not entirely. Mace sighed.
There shouldn't be any other Stas alleys.
Dooku met his eyes.
I should hope not.
His voice was still mild, but a hint of tired threat crept into it.
Elsewise, this office may be forced to act. There won't be any other Stas alleys, Mace repeated. We're still trying to find out what happened there, but I assure you, the matter will be taken care of.
He took a deep breath, trying to find the words for what he wanted to say.
The Order will stand, he said at last. For 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights have been the guardians of peace and justice in the galaxy. That will not end while I still draw breath.
I have no doubt that the Jedi will stand, Dooku said after a moment of thought. A few radicals do not speak for the entirety of the Order. I trust you.
Mace inclined his head in acknowledgement, then sighed as his comlink began to beep.
Excuse me,
he told Dooku, then activated it, listened for a few seconds, and sighed.
I'm needed back at the temple. Excuse me.
Of course. As Mace stood, he remembered one of the reasons he had come to the Senate building in the first place.
Oh!
He reached inside his robes, then held out the object he had retrieved towards Dooku.
We found this while we were searching the wreckage for your attacker. I thought I'd deliver it personally.
Dooku looked at his lightsaber hilt for long enough that Mace thought he might refuse it, then finally reached forward and took it.
I suppose I'll need to become accustomed to using my offhand.
Mace raised an eyebrow.
I heard you refused a prosthetic.
I did. Dooku's expression said that he didn't want to discuss the matter further, so Mace didn't push it. Although the option was always open for Jedi, it was a fairly even split whether or not they chose to take it, one largely divided along philosophical lines. A slightly lower proportion of Jedi accepted prosthetics than among the general population.
If you need a sparring partner, you know where to find me, Mace said, turning to leave.
He hadn't gone more than a few steps before Dooku spoke suddenly.
The Jedi will stand.
Mace turned back.
The Jedi will stand. As long as I still draw breath, the Jedi will stand.
Then the Republic will stand as well. Mace bowed to him, then reached for the door control. The sound of the door sliding open nearly covered Dooku's next words, so soft that they couldn't be much above a whisper. And the Force help us all if either falls. Occupied Naboo, Galactic Republic. Blaster fire rattled in the distance, the half-pitch difference between the SR-9 rifles and S-5 pistols commonly issued to the RNSF reserves, and thus kept in every home in Theed, and the DC-15s and DC-17s carried by both the GAR and RNSF clone troopers. Rex was so used to the sound that he didn't even flinch, though he looked in the direction it had come from. He couldn't see anything, not even the blue and green laser fire that might indicate the position. It didn't really matter. More blaster fire sounded, then the deep boom of a mortar round exploding that made the tiles on the roof he was sitting on shiver. Rex started to reach for the grip of his pistol on instinct, but there wasn't much he could do from up here. He had been out in the muck earlier, bringing in another group of government refugees into the safe house, and it had been brutal, chaotic work. The palace and the RNSF base might have fallen in the first few hours of the attack, but more than 2 weeks later, the fighting was still ongoing in the streets of Theed itself. The invading GAR forces were trying to clear each neighborhood house by house, but after they had gone, more Naboo resistance fighters popped up. By law, nearly every civilian on Naboo was in the RNSF reserves, went to monthly training sessions, and kept weapons in their homes for just this kind of eventuality. They had been made wary by the Trade Federation occupation 12 years earlier. If it hadn't been for the circumstances, Rex might have called it useless paranoia. He still thought it was paranoia, but he had to admit that it was giving the GAR a hell of a time. He had been both sides of an occupied world before. Armed indigenes, especially ones who were trained fighters and had experience with resisting an occupation, never went well. For either side. On the first day of the invasion, it had taken him, Lady Mortier, and Alpha the better part of a day to make their way across Theed to the government safe house, which was a smallish walled mansion in a neighborhood of smallish walled mansions. They had arrived to find the place full of refugees. Rex wasn't sure what else to call them. From the palace, RNSF Theed City, and various other government facilities, being ruthlessly organized by one of the Queen's other surviving handmaidens. Rex still thought it was a few too many people for a safe house. He'd gotten the impression that both Lady Mortier and Lady Irte thought so too, given some of the things he'd heard them saying to each other. Mortier had said that more people had arrived at the safe house than should have known about it, which was a bad sign for their internal security, and probably meant that they would have to move even before the GAR arrived to clear the neighborhood, which they hadn't yet. Rex gave it another week before that happened. Maybe less. The GAR had arrived with more people than he was used to having. The Republic hadn't been able to devote this many troops to a single planetary invasion since the beginning of the war back home. Rex was up on the roof because it gave him a decent view of the city, and because, as much as some of them looked like it, none of the people downstairs were his people. They were good people. That was pretty clear. Rex knew soldiers, and even the ones who were civilians now had all been soldiers once. But they weren't his people. And while that hadn't seemed like a big deal before, it sure as blazes felt like one now. The bright summer sunshine made the situation feel even more surreal. Smoke drifted slowly over the rooftops. Rex couldn't tell from here what was burning, but something had been burning every day since the Republic invasion. Either the Resistance set the fires to draw in Republic troops, or the fires were started accidentally by either side detonating explosives. Rex couldn't bring himself to approve, but the Resistance was pretty effective. He was glad that he hadn't found himself on the other side of this fight. Though at least you'd be with your brothers then. Rex frowned and looked down at the helmet he was holding. It wasn't exactly the same as the ones that the GAR had used back home, modified in slightly different ways and a little narrower. But over the past few weeks it had picked up enough wear and tear to knock the shiny out of it, and at least he didn't feel like a walking target anymore in the previously untouched armor. He wasn't in armor now, One of the gunships circling the city would undoubtedly notice an armored clone trooper sitting on a rooftop, but it made him feel better. He took the paintbrush out of the half-empty can of blue paint beside him, shaking the excess paint off the end. He'd already outlined the T-slit of the helmet in blue. Now all that was left were the finishing touches. Rex considered the helmet for a moment, then braced the back against his knee and held it in place with his left hand. Gauging the distance by eye, he drew a single diagonal line up from the center of the helmet, above the T-slit, then arced it down in a sharply angled curve that left the bottom of the triangle open. He repeated the action on the opposite side of the helmet, then added a pair of short lines between them to complete the J-guys. He dropped the brush back into the paint can and held the helmet between both hands, looking down at it. Just seeing them made him feel better, though it also felt uncomfortably like a nod towards permanency, as though by painting his markings on the barred helmet, he had accepted that he wasn't getting out of here anytime soon. But clone troopers lived every day without the promise of tomorrow's survival. Rex had long ago learned to take each day as it came. A paint job was one way to make it a little easier, and he'd seen enough Naboo clones with markings painted on their armor to know that his J-guys wouldn't stand out at all. Hell, it wasn't even just clones who did that, since the Naboo had mixed their clones in with their regulars, and Rex had seen that the handful of regs who had trailed the safe house had markings on their armor, too. He put the helmet down and leaned over to take the paintbrush out and replace the lid on the can. He'd do the rest of his armor inside, but he'd wanted the daylight for the J-guys on his helmet. In the distance, a gunship accompanied by two headhunters circled over another part of Theed. Rex stood up to get a better look at it, trying to make out what had drawn the patrol's attention. It was hard to tell from here, but he thought that it might have been the source of the smoke. He hoped that the members of the Resistance had probably started the fires, or more likely blown something up, had gotten out of there in time to avoid getting cornered by the Gar. Rex couldn't do anything for them from here. He checked that the paint on his helmet was dry, then tucked it under his arm and picked up the paint can and brush. On his way down the narrow stairwell, he nearly ran into Alpha. The other clone drew back, frowning a little. Then his gaze went to the helmet Rex was carrying and lit a little with understanding. "Those your colors?"
"Yeah."
Alpha's unit color was blue, too, but it was a brighter blue than the 501st's. Only two other clone survivors had made it in from RNSF Theed City, though Rex had heard rumors that there were more with the other Resistance cells in the city.
"Their ladyships are looking for you," Alpha said. "Come on."
Rex was able to hand the paint can off to someone else as they made their way through the manor's airy hallways, now crowded with refugees that had trickled in from the military base or the other government facilities in the city. Mothier and Dirte had set up their command center in a room that had probably started out as a sitting room or study of some type, circular, and with arched windows that looked out on a walled garden. When Alpha and Rex came in, the door sliding shut and locking behind them, the two handmaidens were standing on either side of a holotable. They were joined by Yvonne de Loca, the home fleet naval commodore who had escaped from Republic custody, and a deeply unhappy-looking Stas Alley. The Jedi Knight had exchanged her robes for civilian clothes, but she had her lightsaber clipped to her belt. She was regarding the hologram in front of her with grim determination. Mortier glanced up as they came in, and Rex set his helmet down on a mostly empty side table. He and Alpha stepped up to the holotable, which at the moment showed a map of Theed, various colors marking out Republic-occupied neighborhoods and Gar installations. "Anything interesting going on outside?"
"Same old," Rex said.
He looked down at the holomap, feeling his breath hitch a little in his throat.
"Those aren't your brothers," he reminded himself.
Just because they had his genes and wore the Gar symbol didn't mean that they had anything to do with him, any more than the Naboo clones did. At least he had fought beside the Naboo clones, killed alongside them, held them when they died under Republic fire. Mothier nodded, and toggled the controls on the holotable, a hologram of the planet replacing the image of the city. The Republic fleet in orbit was marked out in red, so many starships that it looked like a nearly solid mass covering the surface of the planet. Commodore Loca's mouth set at the sight.
Amongst all the red-indicated ships, there were a bare handful of green-indicated ones. The home fleet warships that had been captured rather than destroyed in the space battle. The software still marked them as friendlies, but now they were undoubtedly fully crewed by Republic sailors, if they weren't too badly damaged to fly. Right now, the Republic is jamming all incoming and outgoing transmissions, except for those routed through their own relays, which, on world, are partially run on hard lines out from the palace, Erthia said in her soft voice. We haven't yet been able to determine if the Holonet relays in the system have been destroyed or not, but for now we've been working off the assumption that they haven't been, since the Republic routes some of its own transmissions through them too. Not to mention, I assume they'll eventually want to start pumping out propaganda once they work out how to keep users from riding on those signals, Loka said, crossing her arms over her chest. That too. The temporary relays dropped by the Republic are here, here, and here, Mothier said, pointing them out. They glowed a little brighter on the hologram as she indicated them. We don't have access to surface-to-space missiles that can reach that range, Alpha said. This near one, maybe, if the Republic hadn't already hit all those batteries. The intent isn't to destroy them, Erte said. The Republic can replace them easily, and even if they don't, they can route those transmissions through their own Star Destroyers. What it does mean is that the Republic is currently communications capable. They're no longer dependent on the Milnet relays. Sounding like every word was being dragged out of her, Stas Ali said. The Milnet relays weren't capable of the continuous strain this invasion placed on them. Republic forces on Naboo went out of contact with Coruscant for several weeks as a result. We weren't prepared to deal with continuous transmissions on this scale, on what was previously a limited-use relay system. I remember, Rex began, without thinking about it, then paused as the others all looked at him. Only the two handmaidens knew his origin or why he'd know anything about the Gar. Never mind. He hadn't been in the first wave of troopers deployed to the first invasion of Geonosis, and by the time that he had been field ready, the war had already been raging for several months. But he remembered hearing about it from the other troopers. The old Republic Milnet had been designed for peacetime. It hadn't been equipped to handle the strain of a real war, constant communication and information flow from thousands of systems, and had blacked out several times before the techs on Coruscant had finally worked out a solution. What we need is a hardline connection into the Republic communication system, Mathieu said. Irte and Yifande have been working with some of the intelligence techs that made it out of Glasswater House, and they think they found a way to accomplish that. Let me guess, Alpha said. We're going back to the palace. Right in one. Loka touched the controls, and the hologram of the city reappeared. We're not sure exactly where the Republic has laid their hardlines, but there are only a few options, presuming that they're using our transmission towers. She looked at Stas, who shrugged, her mouth a thin line before she admitted, I was never read into that. If we can get a tap onto one of the hardlines, an actual physical tap, we should be able to piggyback on the Republic communication systems to at least send messages through the Holonet. I won't know if we'll also be able to receive until I get a look at the system, Erthia said. Alpha nodded. What kind of team do you want me to put together? It'll have to be small. Pick two more men, Mothier said. Yifande and I will stay here. Irte and Master Ali will go with you and Captain Rex. A small line appeared between Alpha's brows. Respectfully, my lady, I don't think that's a good idea. Because of me or because of the general? Rex said dryly. Alpha angled a look at him. Both. Well, at least he's honest, Stas muttered. She had her arms crossed over her chest, her shoulders tucked in. Everything about her read as furious. Rex wasn't sure if it was because of the accusation or the position that she had found herself in. It was our decision, Irte said firmly. Alpha looked like he was going to argue anyway, then scowled and subsided, leaning his hands on the sides of the holotable. We could use some Gar armor, he said finally. We could walk in the front door, then, instead of sneaking around.
We'll have to get our hands on some. That shouldn't be too difficult, Loka said. It isn't as though Theed is exactly lacking for Republic clones right now. Alpha nodded and straightened up. He slapped Rex on the shoulder. Come on, he said. We've got work to do. It wasn't the work Rex wanted. It wasn't the place Rex wanted to be. But it was what he had until his generals came back for him and he could go home to his real brothers. Or whatever command word retribution had left of him.
Dock Star System. Confederacy of Independent Systems. The water world of Dock hung in space like a blue gem. It was ornamented by the orbital shipyards where the remnants of the Naboo home fleet were docked, undergoing the necessary repairs to get them spaceworthy again. Further out from the planet, spreading across hundreds of thousands of kilometers of space, was the Naboo First Fleet, which had settled into a wide elliptical orbit of the planet. It was easily the largest collection of warships Ahsoka Tano had ever seen before, and from out here, she had a pretty good view. The N1 Viper she was flying was light and responsive under her hands, slipping through space in a completely different way than the Delta 7B interceptor she had trained on. Ahsoka wove the starfighter between the warships on the furthest edge of the fleet, mostly smaller light cruisers and destroyers rather than the larger, slower battlestars and battlecruisers that were in orbit closer to the planet. Every contact on her sensor board showed friendly, but every now and then she glanced out of her viewport, looking to either side of her Viper, to see the other starfighters that were flying in formation with her. In all, there were 6 starfighters and 1 Starhawk gunship flying this patrol, making up half of the squadron she had been assigned to command. Blue Squadron had been cobbled together from the survivors of the Battle of Naboo. Most of its pilots came from the battle stars that had been lost at Naboo, but who had managed to dock onto the Constellation before it had jumped away. To say that most of them weren't happy about serving under a Jedi, even a Jedi who hadn't been present at Naboo, and one who had left the Order at that, was an understatement. Every time Ahsoka flew with them, this was only the second time, she spent most of the patrol with her shoulders drawn tight, her leku twitching in expectation of being fragged at the first opportunity. But there was nothing she could do about that except try and prove to them that she wasn't a Republic spy. She just didn't know how to do that. Her astromech, an R4 unit who she had nicknamed Raptor, chirped at her. Ahsoka glanced at the message scrolling across her comm board and nodded, then remembered that he couldn't see the gesture and said, "Thanks for the reminder." Sure enough, when she flicked her gaze down quickly at her sensor boards, she saw the Naboo-marked symbols for starfighter units emerging from the Battlestar Formidable's launch tubes. A professional but unfamiliar female voice came over the frequency that the Combat Air Patrol was using, announcing,
"Talon Leader to Blue Squadron, you are relieved."
"Blue Leader to Talon Leader, we stand relieved," Ahsoka responded. "It's been all quiet out here."
"Let's hope it stays that way."
Ahsoka switched to the squadron frequency. "Let's head home, boys and girls." There was no response, but Ahsoka hadn't really expected one. Instead, she saw the other starfighters of Blue Squadron turn away from their former vectors, moving easily through the spread-out ships of the First Fleet as Talon Squadron took their places. The Viper that her boards designated as Talon Leader dipped its wings at Ahsoka in a friendly sort of way as Ahsoka followed the rest of her squadron. Ahsoka returned the gesture, squinting through her viewport in an attempt to get a look at the pilot. Blue Squadron was operating out of Indomitable, the Naboo flagship. She hadn't had a chance to meet any of the personnel on the other 3 Battlestars in the First Fleet, or Relentless, the flagship of the strike group that had been stationed in the system to protect Naboo's warship production. Blue Squadron wove in and out of the screen of warships orbiting Dak, past the smaller escort ships, the destroyers, light cruisers, and heavy cruisers, toward the core of the fleet, where the 3 Battlestars and 20 battlecruisers hung apparently motionless in space. From here,
Ahsoka could just make out the massive bulk of the Battlestar constellation, sitting in space dock with spacesuited workers and maintenance droids crawling over it.
"Indomitable to Blue Squadron,"
came the voice of the Battlestar's communications watchstander.
"You are clear to land."
"Blue Leader to Indomitable. Acknowledged," Ahsoka said. The bay doors on the starboard flight pod were open, giving them a clear path inside. Ahsoka hung back until the other starfighters in her squadron, along with the Starhawk, had landed, then brought her Viper in last. She felt the repulsors engage as the starfighter came to a stop, hovering about half a meter above the deck, and heard Raptor's warning tootle to stay in her cockpit until the pod had retracted. The Indomitable's flight pods weren't pressurized when they were extended, and had no magnetic shields to keep atmosphere inside, the way that a Republic Star Destroyer or a cruiser did. A few moments later, an alert sounded as the pod fully retracted, the entire right wall sliding open to reveal the ship's starboard hangar bay. Ahsoka slid the canopy of her starfighter back and vaulted out of the ship, not waiting for a crewman to bring a ladder over. Raptor followed her out, settling onto the deck with a hum of his repulsors. The other Blue Squadron pilots were climbing out of their starfighters, too, along with the pilot and navigator of the Starhawk assigned to them. Ahsoka took a deep breath and made her way over to them. "That was a good flight. I was thinking..." They walked right past her as if she wasn't there, though one of the clone pilots veered slightly to avoid hitting her. Ahsoka stood still, frozen, feeling blood rush into her cheeks. The eight pilots were talking to each other, a comfortable hum of conversation, but none of them had even made a gesture at acknowledging her presence. She pivoted on one foot to watch their departure, feeling alone and self-conscious, solitary amidst the bustle of the hangar, where deckhands were coming to get the ships off the bay floor and check them over for any damage. Ahsoka stared blankly around, trying to push her hurt aside. She hadn't been at Naboo. She hadn't had anything to do with the invasion or the destruction of the home fleet. It wasn't fair.
"Ma'am, did you need something?"
She bit her lip and looked up at the chief petty officer who had spoken, a Twi'lek woman whose bright pink skin clashed badly with her orange deckhand's jumpsuit. Ahsoka swallowed. "No, thank you, Chief Kasana." She had made sure to learn the names and ranks of the deckhands as soon as Master... Captain... No, it was General now. Kenobi had given her a command. She didn't want anything to go wrong with her Viper just because the deck crews on Indomitable held a grudge against a Jedi Padawan who hadn't had anything to do with the invasion of Naboo, so it was best to be as friendly as possible. "I was just... thinking."
"They'll come around,"
the petty officer said. Someone called her name and she looked over, waving an acknowledgement. "Give them time." Ahsoka made herself smile.
"Thanks, Chief." "Just don't give them any reason not to,"
Kasana added warningly, then saluted and left, her boot heels clicking on the deck.
"I'm not going to," Ahsoka said to her back.
Raptor chirped sympathetically, and she summoned up another smile for him, even though she had never been certain how well droids processed expressions like that. She left Raptor to join the other astromechs, doing whatever astromechs did when they weren't in a starfighter, and made her way out of the hangar, signing out as she did so. The Battlestar Indomitable wasn't quite the largest starship that Ahsoka had ever been on. The year previous, she and Master Plo had been assigned to a mission on board a passenger liner that had been even bigger. But it was large enough that even after a week, she was still finding her way around. By now, though, she at least knew the way from the starfighter hangars to the staterooms that had been assigned to the Jedi. She passed crew members on her way there. A few of them deliberately avoided her, but others acknowledged her with a nod or ignored her, too busy with their own tasks. It was a little better than the treatment that she had gotten from the other members of her squadron, but it wasn't as though she had to trust random members of the Indomitable's crew not to shoot her down in combat. Well, except for the ones operating the ship's guns, she supposed. "I have got to find a way to fix this," Ahsoka thought, waving a hand over the control for the hatch to the suite. It was made up of 2 staterooms connected by a small lounge, meant for long-term visitors to the ship, or diplomatic officials, or, well, Ahsoka didn't know who else. Right now, it was just another point of difference separating her from the other pilots, who were all in barracks.
Another 60 systems, all to the Empire. Palpatine gets a couple more and the name might actually start to mean something.
Master Quinlan glanced up as she came in. He and Master Luminara were sitting on one of the half-moon couches at the center of the circular lounge. Barriss was perched stiffly on the opposite couch, her new cybernetic leg stretched out in front of her, but her other leg bent. She had still been in Indomitable's infirmary when Ahsoka had left on her patrol. She had been in and out since they had joined the First Fleet. The doctors had attached the new leg yesterday, which hadn't done much to draw Barriss out of her lethargy. At least she was in the lounge and not in her stateroom, though, which made a nice change. Ahsoka dropped down onto the couch beside her and smiled at her hopefully. After a moment, Barriss worked up a small smile in response. It didn't quite meet her eyes, but Ahsoka would take it for now. She spread her arms out along the back of the couch, her cramped muscles protesting, and asked, "What happened?" After Barriss, Master Quinlan had taken the worst injuries in the fight on Araxes. He had one arm in a sling, a flex wrap on his left knee, and some colorful fading bruises on his face. He gestured one-handed at the holographic display projected above the table between the 2 couches.
"More star systems fleeing the Republic. Dooku must be having kittens."
"Chancellor Dooku is lucky that he's alive to worry about it," Barriss observed, which made Luminara turn her head so quickly Ahsoka swore she heard the other woman's neck crack. So far, the times Barriss had spoken in anything other than monosyllables could be counted on the fingers of one hand. When Barriss didn't say anything more, Ahsoka blinked and said the first thing that came to mind. "Is the Holonews still showing the duel in the Senate every 20 minutes?
"They stepped it up to every 10 after Dooku gave his broadcast this morning," Quinlan said. "I'm sure you can find it on some frequency somewhere. The pundits just put it on as background noise."
"No thanks," Ahsoka said. "I think the first 50 times was enough." She stretched, wincing as her back popped. It had been a long 6 hours in her cockpit, most of it spent in complete silence. She was pretty sure that the other pilots in her squadron had been talking to each other, but they must have been doing it on a frequency she didn't know, because she hadn't heard anything except the occasional check-ins on the squadron frequency. Luminara gave her a concerned look. "Is everything all right?" Ahsoka's mouth tightened before she could stop herself. It's fine. There was a quiet patrol." She hadn't told any of the others yet about what it was like being the only Jedi, aside from General Kenobi, who didn't really count in the Naboo military, though she suspected that they might have guessed. General Kenobi still hadn't worked out how Quinlan, Luminara, and Barriss would fit into the Naboo chain of command yet, though he'd decided to assign Ahsoka to Blue Squadron, since she was essentially under his direct command as his Padawan. Luminara studied her for a moment, her expression still thoughtful. Since General Kenobi had left with Queen Amidala and Captain Skywalker for reasons that were officially classified, but which Ahsoka suspected had to do with the Republic occupation of Naboo, Luminara had been motherheading both Ahsoka and Barriss. Barriss yelling at her to leave her alone had been the first time she'd said more than 5 words at a time since Raxus. Ahsoka still wasn't certain what had happened on Raxus. The psychic backwash from the Sith artifact activating had knocked out everyone Force-sensitive in a kilometer around, including Anakin Skywalker back in the twilight. The former representative Palpatine had recovered first, presumably because it had been dark energy, and had fled under fire from Queen Amidala. Nobody had known where he had gone until he had made his next Holonet appearance from the Alliance world of Christophsis. The former Alliance world of Christophsis. It was now the Imperial capital. From what we can tell, all Republic forces have pulled back to the Naboo system now that the siege at Both Wai has been broken, Luminara observed, when Ahsoka didn't say anything else. They'll wait for the Queen to come to them, not the other way around.
And Palpatine's still kicking the Alliance, the Empire, Quinlan corrected himself, into shape. There's not much news leaking out from those systems, but from what I've heard, some of the old Alliance worlds aren't happy to find out they've been co-opted into his private kingdom. I doubt he's much more fun than the Senate was. And Force knows they kicked them to the curb as soon as they realized it was an option.
I doubt that it would be so easy to disentangle themselves from the Empire.
Luminara rubbed at the healing lightsaber scars on her cheek, then winced and dropped her hand back to her lap.
But I believe you're correct. Palpatine will need all his forces to consolidate his own power. I doubt he has the ships or the troops to spare to attack this fleet.
So it's a stalemate, Varys said, making them all look at her again. The Empire can't afford to attack the Confederacy or the Republic. The Republic is laying a trap for the Confederacy at Naboo, and doesn't have the forces to spare to challenge the Empire. And all the Confederacy's attention is focused on the Republic for now.
Ahsoka let her head fall back against the couch cushions.
And all three of them are falling apart, too.
Quinlan wiggled a hand.
I'd call it swapping systems, not falling apart. The Republic's not going anywhere, neither is the Confederacy. And it looks like Palpatine spent so long building the Empire that it'll probably stick around, at least as long as he does. The core worlds of each of them aren't going anywhere. Well, except for Naboo, but that's a special case. It's all the Rimworlds that are reevaluating where they stand.
As they all looked at him, he shrugged.
It's a flawed metaphor.
Though essentially accurate, Luminara allowed. The holoprojector between them chimed, signaling an incoming signal. Luminara leaned forward to check the source, then said, It's another holonews report. Republic this time.
What was the last one? Ahsoka asked, curious.
Independent.
She pressed a control, and the star chart vanished, replaced with the symbol for Galaxy 9 Holonews, which was headquartered on Coruscant.
Ahsoka shut her eyes, listening to the familiar tones of Taras Kirpeli, the network's serene anchor.
Most of it was hardly news. The Republic was in chaos, and the Confederacy wasn't much better, and the networks weren't so much keeping up as they were repeating the same thing at different hours of the day. Then Taras Kirpeli said something new, and she sat up abruptly, staring at the hologram.
Recently released Galaxy's Most Wanted list.
Oh, this should be good, Quinlan said, leaning forward.
The image of the Serene woman vanished, replaced by a slowly rotating column of virtual posters, stacked three high and flickering every 30 seconds to reveal new posters. Ahsoka caught sight of her own portrait, scanning the information on the poster quickly.
Ahsoka Tano. Should be considered armed and dangerous. Use caution. Wanted for treason, crimes against the Republic. Species, Togruta. Gender, female. Homeworld, Kyros. Affiliation, Confederacy of Independent Systems, formerly Jedi Order. Last seen, Alderaan System.
She bit her lip, exchanging a look with Varys, whose poster was just below Ahsoka's. The column flickered again, replacing them with Luminara's and Quinlan's images. As the column rotated, she saw General Kenobi's picture, alongside.
"Is that Stas?" Luminara said, shocked.
She hit a control, freezing the hologram, then toggled it so that the other holoposters vanished and the selected one expanded to fill the space.
Stas Alley. Should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. Use extreme caution. Wanted for treason, crimes against the Republic, assault. Species, Talothian. Gender, female. Homeworld, Corellia. Affiliation, Confederacy of Independent Systems, Naboo Resistance, formerly Jedi Order. Last seen, Naboo System.
Quinlan was staring at it, his eyes huge.
"Stas is loyal to the Order," he said blankly. "This can't be right. She went with the assault force to Naboo. This can't be right. If Obi-Wan had a mole in the Order, he would have told me. And it can't have been Stas. That's impossible."
He turned to look at Luminara, who had one hand pressed to her mouth.
"That's impossible," he repeated.
She shook her head slightly. "Is it? We're here."
"Yeah, but we talked to Obi-Wan. I bet my life that Stas hasn't spoken to him in at least a decade. Maybe not since before the occupation."
He stared at the holoprojector for another few seconds, then slumped back in his seat, rubbing a hand over his face.
"What in blazes is going on here?"
"I don't know," Luminara said. "Maybe Obi-Wan will have some answers when he and the Queen get back."
"I could use some answers right about now," Quinlan said.
Ahsoka leaned forward to unfreeze the hologram. Master Ali's holoposter shrank back to its previous size as the rest of the column reappeared, immediately flickering to the next set of images. Quinlan immediately froze it again and crooked a finger at the center image.
"That's her," he said,
all business again.
"Forget Obi-Wan for once. That's the most wanted being in the galaxy right now."
The portrait had clearly been taken by one of the droid cams in the Senate Convocation Chamber, but it had captured her head-on. A pale-skinned woman with blue markings at the corners of her mouth and eyes and along the sides of her bald head. The information on the holoposter was far sparser than it had been for any of the Jedi.
"Name unknown. Should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. Do not approach. Wanted for espionage, multiple counts of murder, multiple counts of attempted murder, assault. Species, believed Dathomiri. Gender, female. Homeworld, unknown. Affiliation, unknown. Last seen, Coruscant system."
Christophsis, Imperial Center, New Galactic Empire. The setting sun filtered down through the crystalline structures of the capital city on the planet Christophsis, painting the landing platform the purplish red of dried blood. Before it had followed Naboo's lead and seceded from the Republic, Christophsis had been a reasonably popular tourist destination, albeit one that, like so many other thousands of planets in the galaxy, lacked Senate representation. The system had broken with Amidala when she had left the Alliance of Sovereign Systems to form the Confederacy. Since then, it had been steadily moldering into obscurity. The tourist trade had dropped nearly to nothing following the outbreak of fighting between the Republic and the Separatists. Although the system was resource-rich and well-situated on a prominent hyperlane, it controlled no hyperpoints, and the minerals mined both on-world and in the system's three asteroid belts were all readily available elsewhere in the galaxy. Neither the Republic nor the Confederacy had paid any attention to it, which had made it perfect for Palpatine's purposes. Even before Naboo's secession, he had owned property in the sector, including a stake in one of the system's prominent mining guilds. He owned property on numerous worlds, of course, some of it even under his own name. That was hardly unusual for Naboo nobles of a certain rank. Even the Naberis had off-world holdings. But Christophsis's resources and location made it particularly useful for him. The dramatic setting even made it aesthetically striking, appropriate for his new empire. Palpatine watched the blunt-nosed infiltrator angle down towards him, sliding efficiently through the crystal towers surrounding the area. It flattened out to land, its curved wings folding inwards as it touched down. A few moments later, a hatch at the back of the round cockpit opened, a landing ramp extending. He felt the figure who descended as a shadow in the Force, made familiar now by long exposure. She came towards him without hesitation, sinking to one knee before him. Her black skirts puddled around her as she bowed her head, her hood shadowing her pale features.
"I have failed you, my master."
"Yes."
Palpatine let the single syllable hang in the air, feeling her reaction in the Force. She didn't look up, didn't reach for her lightsabers, merely remained where she was, her gaze fixed on the glassy surface of the landing platform. But he could sense her response, the quick calculation behind her pale eyes, and the fear of the punishment that her admission of failure might entail. Palpatine had been very harsh regarding such matters in the past. This time, though, he let her wait. He stepped aside, pacing slowly around her, letting her fear and her anger drag out in the Force before he spoke again.
"The Chancellor," he said at last, "lives. The Queen of Naboo lives. And the Jedi are whole."
"You did not order me to destroy the Jedi. I could have killed Yoda."
"Silence!"
He turned on her, and her head, which had started to rise, went down again. Palpatine saw her long, pale fingers working where they were clasped around her left knee.
"The Chancellor," he said again, "lives. But he has been forced to reveal his true colors, and the Senate will not forget that."
The Galactic Senate's memory was short far too often, but there were things that it could not, would not, forget. And Palpatine thought that this was one of them. Dooku had used the Senate's temperamental nature against him 7 years ago. Let him suffer its effects now.
"Let me kill Queen Amidala for you, my master," said his apprentice, when Palpatine did not go on. "I will put an end to that—"
"As you did, Dooku."
Still circling her, in front of her again now, he saw her lips skin back from her teeth.
"Amidala is just a woman. Without her, the Confederacy will collapse."
"The Confederacy is a tool. Amidala is a tool. Together, they will weaken the Jedi and the Republic. And when they have all battered each other to exhaustion, my Empire will be there to take what remains in hand."
She looked up now.
"I thought it was our empire, my master," she added, nearly as an afterthought.
"Yes," Palpatine said, a little amused. "Our empire. When the Republic and the Confederacy are no more, then you and I will rule the galaxy."
"And the Jedi?"
"The Jedi will destroy Kenobi and his band of renegades, and once they have done that, they will devour themselves. I have seen it."
And what a pleasant vision that had been. The Jedi had been complacent for too long, had spent their time looking in the shadows for monsters that had not been there. And sooner rather than later, the Order would tear itself apart. The Force was no longer with the Jedi. They would come to know that with time. Palpatine had played his hand too soon, and for that he would undoubtedly pay. Was paying now, and would continue to do so. But at least he was out from Amidala's thumb. And there were advantages to be had from that as well, not least the fact that he no longer had to live under the same roof as a Grey Jedi, for that was what Obi-Wan Kenobi had been then. Now, Palpatine thought, he was something more. The fools had made him a knight, all the better to devil them. And he had had strange allies. The legends of the Sith were as ancient as those of the Jedi, their records painstakingly passed down from master to apprentice. Palpatine had long ago moved his collection of Sith holocrons off Naboo, wary that Kenobi might sense some hint of their presence, and he had been searching their records since he had escaped from Roxas. He had found it at last, buried in records that long preceded Darth Bane. The Ouroboros of Jor Mungar, the snakes that guarded the barriers of space and time, stolen and promptly lost millennia ago by some Jedi fools. And then found, in some other time and some other place, by the Jedi. Power called to power. Darkness to darkness. Palpatine hoped that the Jedi had joy of the thing, for he thought that it would lead them only to their deaths. No thing of the Sith would ever be kind to a Jedi. It would lead them further and further away from their own place, and then, he thought, it would either leave them or destroy them. That was what came to the Jedi who interfered in the affairs of the Sith. But they had told Palpatine something that he had not known before. That the Ouroboros yet existed, and that somewhere in the galaxy there was a boy, not a Jedi here in his universe, of immense power. Palpatine meant to find them both. He looked down at his apprentice, still kneeling before him. Asajj Ventress was strong in the Force, and the ways of the dark side had made her stronger still, but there was nothing particularly extraordinary about her. She was as Maul had been before her. A weapon. A tool to be used and then discarded once it broke, or if something better came along. And Palpatine wanted something better.
"Your failure is not unredeemable," he told her. "I will make it serve our purposes. But do not forget that it was your failure, my apprentice."
"My master!" She stopped her protest as he angled a look at her.
"Go to General Grievous," Palpatine said. "Accept whatever task he has for you until I decide that you have made up for your failure. There is resistance amongst the Alliance worlds, and they must learn their place in my empire."
"Should we bother ourselves with a rabble, my master?" she asked. "We have revealed ourselves to the Jedi."
"And we will have our revenge," Palpatine said. "In time. Now leave my sight. I have no wish to see your face until your failure has been remedied."
She bowed her head slightly in acknowledgement, then stood, leaving in a swirl of black fabric. Palpatine did not watch her go. Instead, he stood and looked at the setting sun, its light still caught in the planet's crystal structures.
"Yes, the Jedi would die. The Republic and the Confederacy would both fall. And when they were all gone, only he and his empire would remain. And the Sith would have their revenge."
Occupied Naboo Star System, Galactic Republic. "This feels familiar," Queen Padmé Amidala thought, but didn't bother voicing the words. Obi-Wan, she knew, had to be thinking the same thing, and it wouldn't mean anything to Ani. The twilight had exited hyperspace at the edge of the debris field furthest from Naboo itself, as calculated from the constellation's last sensor readings from the system. While the escape pods, both Naboo and Republic, had already been picked up,
but the wreckage of warships still drifted along their last vectors. The twilight nosed slowly amongst them, powered down low enough that Ani Skywalker swore it wouldn't be more than a blip on even military sensors. Not enough to raise any concern on a battlefield still littered with half-powered droids and a few engines here and there that had survived their ship's destruction. The battlefield was a little below the plane of the star. Above them, Padme could see the familiar, much-loved orb of the planet, mostly in darkness on this side, with a sliver of light just visible on the side nearest the star. Around the planet hung the ships of the Republic fleet. From here, they appeared still and unmoving, but Padme knew they were all in orbit around the planet, gliding along at hundreds of thousands of kilometers per hour. Even having come from the First Fleet, which could almost certainly match the Republic fleet ship for ship, the sight took Padme's breath away. She dug her fingers into the back of Obi-Wan's chair, her grip white-knuckled as she peered at the viewport. "We can match them ship for ship, but that will cost us ship for ship, and there's no way we'll be able to hold a planet without a fleet." "I'm picking up 3 friendlies on the boards," Obi-Wan said, his voice calm and professional. "Friendlies?" Padme tore her gaze away from the viewport and looked over his shoulder at the sensor boards. Ani, in the co-pilot seat, glanced over too. "It's superb, gallant, and daring," Obi-Wan said, naming a battlecruiser and 2 heavy cruisers from the home fleet. "They must have been captured during the battle. The fleet net is uploading their damage reports now." "Will the Republic sailors on board notice that?" Obi-Wan glanced up at the viewport, but none of the Republic ships there seemed to have taken notice of them. "I don't think so. They might not have thought to disconnect them from the fleet net, since there's no point without the rest of the fleet here." Ani had vociferously protested hooking the Twilight into the fleet net, arguing that the Twilight wasn't part of the Naboo Space Navy, and they didn't want every bridge officer on every ship in the fleet to have any idea of his ship's capabilities. Padme had wanted the Twilight in the net as long as Ani was in her employ. She didn't know what sort of situations they might need to prepare for, and she wanted fleet ships to be able to back them up without hesitation if it came to that. Obi-Wan had worked out a compromise, allowing the Twilight to receive reports from the net, but not to send out anything beyond its transponder signal. Padme still wasn't happy about that, but she supposed the chances that they would be within reception range of the fleet net but out of communications were slim. "This is weird," Ani noted, as he eased the ship down slightly to avoid a large piece of wreckage, wincing as it scraped over the top of the ship. Padme turned her head to look at him. "Why? Big battle like this? There should be at least a dozen salvage crews out here. We're passing some valuable equipment that could go for a lot on the black market." He gestured with one hand towards the viewport, where the remains of an N-1 starfighter were drifting past. It looked almost intact, until they got closer, and Padme saw that the Transparastil canopy was shattered, glass marks on the seat. There was no sign of the pilot. "That's gotta be hundreds of thousands of creds just sitting out here." "He's right," Obi-Wan said after a moment of thought. "Especially since, after the Holonews broadcasts, everyone in the galaxy knows a battle was fought here. The Republic must be chasing off salvage crews." "Why?" Padme asked. He shrugged. "I don't know." "If I wasn't being paid for this, I'd be out there myself," Ani admitted. "I could find a buyer for some of this real easy, even with the trouble it would take to get it on board. The Twilight's not set up for salvage work." Padme frowned a little, disapproving. Leaving aside the fact that it was her ships in ruins out there, salvage always struck her as being too much like robbing the dead. She had done enough of that during the occupation 13 years ago, though, so she didn't remark on it. Maybe Ani didn't know enough to call her a hypocrite, but Obi-Wan certainly did. The Twilight eased slowly forwards towards the edge of the debris fields, closer in to the planet. Padme stayed standing, instead of retreating to one of the stations on either side of the cockpit, watching the planet grow gradually larger in the viewport.
The planet and the Republic fleet surrounding it.
Ani and the fleet engineers back on Indomitable had spent some time upgrading the Twilight sensors. They were recording everything in the system to be taken back to Indomitable and analyzed for weaknesses. They were also dropping surveillance drones at irregular intervals, though someone would have to come back to collect them in order to retrieve that data. All right, Obi-Wan said eventually, his gaze fixed on the sensor boards in front of them. Padme swallowed and glanced down. Do we have broadcast capabilities? He shook his head. No. From what we're picking up, it looks like all incoming and outgoing transmissions in the system are being jammed unless they're routed through the Republic communications net. We'll have to do this the hard way. Padme sighed. Well, at least we'd planned for that. Start scanning for satellites or relays we can slice into. She looked up as Ani angled the Twilight away from a particularly large piece of wreckage. This close, Padme could make out the man-sized Arabesh letters on it before they cut off mid-word. Beneath it, the same letters were repeated in Futhark. That's from Indefatigable, she said, swallowing. The Battlestar had been intact, if damaged, when Constellation and the other ships had jumped away, but it must have been destroyed afterwards. I hope you found them, made it off. Obi-Wan didn't say anything. They both knew that the chances Ifande Loka hadn't fought her Battlestar to the end were small. The only way she wouldn't have gone down with her ship was if she had been knocked out and dragged into an escape pod. After a moment, he said, "Here's the nearest Republic communications relay." "Shoot that to me?" Ani asked, and a moment later studied his own boards. "It's pretty far from the blockade. No Republic ships are on there, but we'll be out from the cover of the debris field." He bit his lip, his face creased in concentration. "Once they notice us, it'll only take those Republic ships a minute or two to get there. Maybe three." "Can you do it?" Padme asked him. He took a deep breath, looking out the viewport at the Republic ships. "Yeah. I can't go to full power without them picking us up on scanners, though. I can maybe... Nah, that's not gonna work." "What?" Obi-Wan asked. "I was gonna say I could fix the transponder signal to read as one of the Republic ships, but that's only gonna work if we're actually in among the fleet, because they'll notice a ship out where one shouldn't be, and I don't... really want to do that." "Let's avoid that," Padme agreed. "All right, Captain, let's do it. Take as much time as you need." Ani took her at her word, clearly spooked at being under the noses of so many hostile warships. It was almost 20 minutes before they finally sidled up alongside the Republic communications relay, Obi-Wan peering out the viewport at it as Ani braked the Twilight. He stood up as the ship matched the relay, both of them in a slow orbit around the star.
"I'd better get suited up," he said, pressing a kiss to Padme's cheek. "Come on, R2.
The astromech warbled and started to roll after him as Padme slid into Obi-Wan's vacated seat. Ani tapped a control and straightened upright.
"I'll come too," he said. "You might need another pair of hands, and I've got an extra suit."
Padme turned in her chair to watch Obi-Wan consider him silently.
"All right," he said at last.
"Be careful," Padme said. Obi-Wan held up the data spike he was holding.
"This shouldn't take long."
Padme looked back at the viewport as the two men left the cockpit, hearing Ani say,
"Hey, 3PO, hold the fort, will you?"
A moment later, the protocol droid came tottering in, settling gingerly in one of the other seats. "I must say, Your Highness, I'm terribly uncomfortable with all of this," he confided to her. "I'm not very fond of it either," Padme said, leaning an elbow on the arm of the co-pilot's chair she was occupying and resting her chin in the palm of her hand. Part of her wished that she was the one going out there. But Obi-Wan and Ani were both better equipped to do this than she was, and someone needed to stay in the twilight. Besides, her doctors had told her that going on spacewalk while pregnant was extremely ill-advised. She touched her fingers lightly to her stomach, then heard the calm crackle. Tearing her gaze away from the mass of ships in orbit around Naboo, she hooked an earpiece on and said, "You boys ready?"
"Opening the airlock now,"
Obi-Wan said, his voice crisp and professional.
"I'll try not to get lost."
"I would prefer that, yes," Padme said dryly. She glanced down at the boards, seeing the light that indicated one of the Twilight's two airlocks was open to space. Just knowing that part of the ship wasn't sealed against vacuum had the hair on the back of her neck rise. The relay was visible from the viewport. Padme, watching, saw Ani and Obi-Wan appear, moving with the aid of repulsors on their hands and feet, and tethered to the ship by a pair of long, thin fiber cords. They landed on the side of the relay, clinging to the thing as R2-D2 sped out after them. Padme pushed her hands against her thighs, watching nervously as Obi-Wan pried up a panel to reveal a data port.
"All right, R2, install the spike,"
she heard Obi-Wan say, as the astromech maneuvered itself into place with little spurts of its thrusters. Obi-Wan pried up another panel to get at the keyboard beneath it, Ani hovering at his shoulders. Padme looked back at the Republic fleet, wary of any indication that the action had raised some alarm somewhere. But none of the Republic ships seemed to have noticed them. Yet. She kept one eye on the fleet and one eye on the boards over the next few minutes, listening to Ani and Obi-Wan talk softly. It seemed like a long time later that Ani finally said,
"Okay, we got it. Let's close her up and get out of here."
He and Obi-Wan quickly replaced the cover panels as R2 disengaged from the relay. In less than 30 seconds, all three of them were on their way back to the Twilight, their hand and foot repulsors glowing slightly against the vast blackness of space. Padme didn't realize she was holding her breath until the light showing that the airlock was open turned green, and Obi-Wan said,
"We're all aboard."
She let out her breath in a rush. A moment later, Ani and Obi-Wan came back into the cockpit, both still in their spacesuits, but with the helmets removed. Padme stood up so that Obi-Wan could have the co-pilot's seat again, Ani sliding into the pilot's seat and reaching for the controls. He turned the Twilight away from the relay, moving it in a long, slow loop back towards the relative safety of the debris field. "Please, don't install that thing until we're at least nominally undercover," he said. "How long will we have once it's active?" Padme asked Obi-Wan, who was holding the spike in one hand.
"About 5 minutes at most, more likely 2 or 3. We'll have to stay in system, but it'll route through the relay and make it look like that's the source of the transmission."
"All right," Padme said, licking her lips. "Let's make it count." They eased about a kilometer back into the debris field before Ani judged them far enough away that the power spike of the comms system probably wouldn't register amidst the other detritus left among the battlefield. As R2 rolled over to plug into the communications board, Obi-Wan slid the spike into another data port.
"This will give us an override broadcast to every communications device in the system capable of receiving from the holonet," he said,
standing so that Padme could take a seat in front of the communications console, in range of the holoprojector.
"You've got audio and holo...
now." She took a deep breath. Ever since the occupation, she had been able to hide behind her face paint, but she was tired of hiding now. And the last thing she needed was to create any more doubt about who was speaking. This was her own face and no one else's, and she wanted everyone on Naboo, the Republic and her own people alike, to know it. "To the people of the Sovereign System of Naboo," she said, "this is Queen Padme Amidala." She paused. She knew she didn't have the time to spare, but she couldn't stop herself. "You know my voice," she went on finally. You know my face. This is not a republic trick. I will not give you platitudes. I will not give you excuses. Naboo was betrayed. Many of our people died fighting in an attempt to preserve Naboo's liberty. I promise you that their sacrifices will not be in vain. Through the viewport and on the sensor screens, she could see some of the Republic ships swinging around, angling in towards the communications relay they had sliced into. They hadn't detected the twilight yet. This is not the first occupation Naboo has survived, but I swear to you that it will be the last. The Republic thinks, as the Trade Federation thought, that we are weak. They believe that this will break us, that we will roll over and beg for mercy, that we will surrender, that we are not willing to fight for our own freedom. But I know better. Ani's fingers flexed on the Twilight's control yoke. Obi-Wan didn't say anything, his gaze fixed on the viewport on the Republic ships. You are not alone, Padme said. You are not forgotten. And you are not weak. Naboo has never been weak, and the Republic will learn that to their peril. Something began to beep urgently from Ani's side of the cockpit. Padme barely kept herself from flinching, hearing Ani say, "They've spotted us. I'm going into full power." Lights brightened in the cockpit. Padme felt the ship's engines rumble into full life beneath her. Ani gripped the steering yoke and sent the Twilight leaping forward, heading for the edge of the debris field in clear space. R2, I need that hyperspace jump plotted now. I am coming for you, Padme said, reading the look Obi-Wan shot her. I don't care how long it takes. Naboo will be free. Stay strong. Trust each other. And fight for all you are worth. Another alarm went off. We've got incoming ordnance, Obi-Wan said. Missile lock on the relay, ion missiles on us. They're going to knock out our systems to take us alive. Padme, and to the Jedi, Padme said, hearing the snarl in her voice. To the soldiers and the sailors of the Republic. To Admiral Tarkin. I am coming for you, too. Jump now, Obi-Wan said, and Ani pulled the hyperspace lever down as the ion missiles came so close that their glare was all Padme could see. In the instant before the Twilight jumped to hyperspace and the transmission terminated into static, Padme breathed. This is Queen Padme Amidala of Naboo. I'll see you on the other side. Somewhere else. Senator Padme Amidala came back to herself in darkness. She stood still, breathing hard, adrenaline making her tremble uncontrollably. A moment ago she had been in a firefight, or at least the aftermath of one. Now she clearly wasn't. That gave her time. Maybe not a lot of time, but at least enough time to get herself under control before trying to work out where she was and what had happened. She counted to 10. Found herself still shaking, and then slowly counted back from 10, letting her breath even out as she did so. When she finished, there was still a slight tremble in her fingers, but she could live with that. Breathing hard, she checked the blaster in her holster. She'd run out of charges during the firefight on Araxes and hadn't had a chance to reload. Her ammo pouch had been torn away during the struggle with the clone. But Padme had been doing this sort of thing long enough to know not to keep all her spare ammunition in one place. She found a charge pack in the pocket of her tunic, ejected the spent one, and pushed the new one home, feeling a little better as soon as she saw the indicator light on her blaster change from red to green. Holding it in one hand, she finally looked around herself. The darkness wasn't complete. Panels of red lights illuminated it at regular intervals, though they didn't provide enough light to really see by. The walls of the corridor she was standing in sloped at wide angles. Familiar angles, Padme recognized after a moment.
She hadn't spent a lot of time in Republic military complexes, but she recognized the distinctive hexagonal shape of the corridors, with four long sides and four short ones. The lights were on protruding panels. Am I home? But if she was home, then where were Anakin and Obi-Wan? Padme swallowed. Either they were here somewhere, or they weren't. And if they weren't, then there was nothing Padme could do to help them. Ancestors, help me. Please let me be home. Somewhere in the distance, an alarm began to sound. Padme flinched reflexively, starting to raise her blaster before realizing that there was nothing to fire at. Instead, she drew back alongside the nearest wall, bracing herself between two of the lighting protrusions, which might offer her a little cover. The alarm kept blaring, more of them activating and growing quickly louder, coming in her direction. Padme hesitated for a long moment, wondering what to do. The alarms couldn't be reacting to her presence. They would have started here if they had. She did know that being in a Republic facility when an alarm was going off was a very bad idea. An alarm activated almost directly above her, making Padme clap her hands to either side of her head, the metal of her blaster barrel cool against her forehead as she covered her ears. It covered up the sound of running footsteps, until someone very familiar skidded to a stop in front of her. "Padme?" Anakin gasped. Or at least that was what Padme thought he had said. She could barely hear him. "What? Never mind. Come on!" He grabbed her free hand and dragged her away from the wall into a run. Padme followed him, too stunned to protest, but unable to shake the feeling that something was very wrong. He had his lightsaber in his right hand, but hadn't ignited it yet. His lightsaber. They went dashing down the corridor, alarms activating just ahead of them. Padme didn't know who or what they were running from, but she trusted Anakin. He led her unerringly through twisting corridors, until coming to a stop so quickly that Padme almost ran into his back. "Halt, rebels!" She could barely hear the voice over the sound of the screaming alarms, but when she peered around Anakin's shoulder, she saw a trio of white-armored clone troopers standing in a V formation, blocking the way down the corridor. They all had their blasters raised. Anakin let go of her hand and ignited his lightsaber, flicking it out to one side. "I don't think so," he said. In the red-lit gloom of the corridor, the blue glow of the blade clung to the angles of his face, making him look otherworldly, like something out of a dream. Padme raised her blaster, a little uncertain, but she remembered all too well the clones turning on her and Obi-Wan in the Senate building, and the adrenaline from the firefight on Raxus was still humming in her veins. There was a moment of hesitation, as if the clones were conferring amongst themselves over their helmet tight beams. Then the blaster fire started. Anakin moved blindingly fast, shoving Padme back behind the meager shelter of one of the panels protruding from the wall. His lightsaber flashed in the shadows, sending oncoming blaster bolts into the floor, ceiling, walls, and back of the clone troopers. It was all over in a matter of seconds. Anakin deactivated his lightsaber as Padme stepped cautiously out from the wall. He was looking down at the dead clones, a grimace on his face. "They'll have called it in. Come on." Padme followed him, stepping gingerly around the bodies before Anakin started to run again. The alarms were still ringing in her ears as they ran through the corridors, and several times she looked back over her shoulder, expecting to see more clone troopers following them at any moment. At last, they came skidding to a halt in front of what she at first thought was a dead end, before she blinked in the gloom and realized it was a door. Anakin hit a button on the control panel, and scowled when the door didn't open. He frowned at it for a moment, then said, "Watch my back," and ignited his lightsaber, plunging it two-handed into the door. Padme turned, raising her blaster to cover the corridor. The screaming alarms were making her head hurt, and it was difficult to see anything in the poorly lit corridors. The red lights mostly only revealed the location of the walls. If there had been any chance of Anakin hearing it, she would have asked where Obi-Wan was, but that would have to wait.
Fortunately, clone trooper armor stood out even against the gloom. She thumped a fist into Anakin's shoulder to get his attention and said, "Incoming!" He glanced over his shoulder, saw the clones, and said, "These guys just don't give up." He had cut about 3/4 of a circle into the door, but he withdrew his lightsaber and flipped it around in his hand as he turned to face the clones, pushing Padme behind him with his free hand.
"You really don't want to do this," he said,
half snarling the words. If there was any forced compulsion in his voice, Padme couldn't tell. The clones looked at each other. Then the one with an officer's comma and pauldron said,
"Anakin Skywalker, you are under arrest for crimes against the Empire. Put your weapon down and put your hands on your head."
The Empire? There was no humor in Anakin's grin.
"It didn't work the last time, it's not working this time. And you can take that straight to Emperor Dooku."
Oh no, Padme thought. Oh no, oh no, oh no.
"Set for stun," the clone officer ordered, and Padme saw several settings being flipped on blaster rifles.
"Please," Anakin said. "Try." But before anyone could start shooting, there was a muffled explosion. The whole building seemed to shake, sending them all reeling. Anakin caught himself with one hand against the floor as Padme staggered back against the door. She could feel the heat where he had been cutting a few moments earlier. And the clones fell heavily in all directions. As they were still recovering, he thrust a hand out. The clones went flying away from them, landing in a limp pile further down the hallway. Padme pulled herself to her feet, backing away from Anakin as he turned back to the door. He finished cutting the circle out, then kicked at it with one foot. As it went flying out of the opening, another explosion rocked the building, closer this time.
"Time to go," Anakin said brightly, as they both caught their balance.
Since sticking around didn't seem like a particularly favorable option, Padme climbed out through the hole, emerging onto an empty watch platform that looked out over a river and, from the sound, a nearby waterfall. She looked up automatically, seeing a cloudless sky with 3 moons in it. The comm link on Anakin's left wrist began to beep urgently. Or had been beeping for a while, maybe. Padme wouldn't have been able to tell amidst the sound of the alarms, but outside that was muted, which at least was a relief for her pounding head. Anakin jabbed at the comm link.
"You'd better be ready, Master Luminara, because I've just about worn out my welcome."
A half-familiar female voice said,
"I've sliced into the system. A few more minutes."
"I don't really have a few more minutes."
Another voice, this one the familiar timbre of a clone trooper, cut in.
"Cody here. We'll handle it, General. Get out of there. You've got half the base headed."
Blaster bolts struck the railing Padme was standing beside. She jerked back, raising her blaster automatically.
"I know!"
Anakin almost shouted at his comlink, then pulled something off his belt and flung it through the hole into the building. Padme heard it hit the ground and roll. It was a thermal detonator. Anakin caught her around the waist and pulled her up on top of the narrow railing.
"Jump!"
The thermal detonator went off just as they did so, debris blowing out behind them as they plummeted towards the river below. Padme hit the icy water hard enough that she nearly bit her own tongue off, though she managed to keep hold of her blaster. She emerged, sputtering and gasping, in time to see something else explode above her, briefly lighting up the night sky. Treading water, Padme stared up at what was unmistakably a Republic installation. Or what had been, anyway. Anakin caught at her arm as the river tried to sweep them along.
"Come on," he said.
As Padme nodded, he started paddling awkwardly towards the shore opposite the sheer cliff where the Republic installation was. Anakin had never been a good swimmer. The current tried determinedly to sweep them downstream toward the waterfall Padme could hear, but they came up on the shore, about 1/2 kilometer away from the installation. Padme sat down heavily on the bank, staring at it. There was smoke billowing up into the night sky, along with occasional gouts of flame.
"I hope Ani and Obi-Wan aren't in there."
Invisible fingers closed around her throat, dragging her upright. Padme gasped something that might have been a scream if she had had the breath for it, clawing at her neck with both hands, but there was nothing there to fight against. Anakin was walking toward her with one hand held out, his gloved fingers curved as though he had them around her neck. He had his lightsaber hilt in his other hand. His lightsaber hilt, the one Padme hadn't seen her Anakin carry since he had been deployed to Odrin all those months ago. Now Padme saw, as she hadn't before, that there was a second lightsaber on his right hip. Obi-Wan's lightsaber. The fact that he was wearing civilian clothes hadn't even registered for her after the past few weeks, but it should have. Her Anakin had been in robes for the confrontation in Congress, and she had never thought... "I have 3 questions," Anakin said, "and you'd better hope I like the answers." His wet hair was plastered against his skull, water running in thin rivulets down his forehead. As she stared, there was another explosion behind him, so that for a moment his face was cast in shadow as the sky lit up yellow and orange. Padme scrambled weakly at her throat, trying and failing to step away. "Who are you?" Anakin said. "What were you doing on an Imperial base at the same time we were sneaking in? And why?" His face twisted into a snarl as he bit off the next words. "Why do you look like my wife?" The end.